Welcome to the 2020 Christmas special of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I am film watcher Greg Ralph.
So we're here, Greg.
Ho.
Ho.
And that's only a one-ho Christmas.
It's 2020, it's just a ho.
You probably have noticed we've been a bit silent this year.
That's right.
We have actually been recording across this year in lockdown in Melbourne, which has been pretty full on.
It has, yeah.
And I know that both you and I are awfully happy that we've reached the end of the year. And next year is going to be fantabulous.
Yes, it will be.
If for no other reason than we've been recording episodes that will start coming out early in the new year.
That's right. Episode one will drop in January.
In the all-new improved 2021. But for the moment, yes. Let's just park that with all those unpleasant memories of 2020 and talk about Christmas.
That's right.
Cue angels singing and bells jingling.
And we hope, you know, amongst everything, that you are actually trying to have a great Christmas.
Yes.
At this time, which, you know, I'm trying to really enjoy it. And I look at the lights on the houses and it just makes me feel that warm, tingly feeling.
And I know that both of us are both just going to absolutely love all three of these Christmassy films, right?
Well, let's get started.
So tell me and the fine folks at home, Ricardo, what are we actually doing this time around?
Well, the first film we're going to be discussing is the 1993 film, A Nightmare Before Christmas.
Followed smoothly by 1983's A Christmas Story.
And then finally to the 2019 film, Last Christmas.
So let's ding-dong merrily on high straight away, Ricardo. And why don't you tell us about A Nightmare Before Christmas?
Even though the characters and story were imagined by Tim Burton, this musical animation was actually directed by Henry Selick, who also made the film Coraline. The idea actually came from a poem Tim Burton wrote while working at Disney. In Halloween Town, it's the same routine every year. On Halloween, the monsters come out to scare. However, this particular Halloween, the Pumpkin King, Jack Skellington, speaking voice by Chris Sarandon and singing voice by composer Danny Elfman, is bored with doing the same thing every year for Halloween. That missing something might be Sally, Catherine O'Hara, a ragdoll who yearns for Jack, but he doesn't notice. Sauntering off into the woods with his dog Zero after Halloween night, he discovers some trees with different doors representing various holidays. Of course, the Christmas tree door attracts his attention, and upon entrance into the world of Christmas, he's fascinated. Jack Skellington decides to spread Christmas joy to the world. He does his best to get his resident bats, ghouls, and goblins of Halloween Town to help him put on Christmas instead of Halloween. But his well-meaning mission unwittingly puts Santa Claus in jeopardy and creates a nightmare for all good little boys and girls everywhere. So much so that it has to be saved. The stop-motion animation, also known as claymation in this film, is a marvel. It took 3 years to make this. 1 minute of film took 1 week of shooting. They sculpted the characters with oil-based clay, which is very versatile and can be smoothed out with alcohol.
Like most of us.
Yeah. After 2020? Absolutely. And each character had a skeleton armature, enabling the animators to move the puppets into specific postures during the shoot. Jack Skellington himself had around 400 heads with different expressions. Now, the way it works is that rather than filming moving objects, the crew has to move the figures and sets little by little, taking still photographs, and then they play them back quickly to simulate movement. The sets were all miniature, but lit like large sets, requiring as many as 30 lights. Even though claymation is usually recorded at 12 frames per second and shown at 24 frames a second, for A Nightmare Before Christmas, the scenes were filmed at 24 frames per second. This means they had to actually change the pose of the character 24 times for each second of the actual completed film. Now, they had to work with storyboards, obviously, laying out the entire scene and making refinements before the very time-consuming process of animation was started. But even though technically this is just wonderful, I've actually never really warmed to it as much as I know others have. I can never really get into the musical numbers of the film, nor really the characters that much. I've tried to watch this a few times, but it never fully draws me in, which is quite frustrating because it's just a wonder to look at. Greg, what did you think about A Nightmare Before Christmas?
Well, actually, I'm the same. Mm. So you look at it as a technical accomplishment,
mm-hmm.
10 out of 10.
Yeah.
You look at it in terms of a sustained vision, the same. And you know, Tim Burton was not intimately involved in the making of this film.
No.
The crew who made it were based in San Francisco, deliberately away from Disney Central to remove the kind of interference. Had a very supportive producer assigned by Disney who really fought the battles for them.
That's right.
And Tim Burton was fully engrossed in making Batman Returns, you know, the second film.
That's right.
And so I think he popped out a few times, but really he trusted the director, Henry Selick,
mm-hmm.
and another chap who he trusted, who was a visual sculptor. All three of them had met in the early days at Disney Animation as kind of outsiders. And so he was removed at a distance, but he gave very clear directions, things like, there are no right angles in Halloween Town. The only colour palette is black, white and orange. So
right,
it's his vision,
right, okay, sure.
But others were then running with it. So technically, and the way that it, you have to be reminded it's not actually Burton who's the director.
No, it's Henry Selick.
And the film, strictly speaking, is called Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, which was done as a branding exercise.
Of course
because Disney
it was.
Wasn't quite sure what they had originally and so on.
Yeah.
But so it's really, it's his baby through and through. But you're right about the story.
Mm.
And I think part of the reason is that the way the film was created was they had the poem he wrote,
mm-hmm.
and there's an early version of it being read by Christopher Lee.
Oh, right.
That I watched
right, great.
On my DVD extras. Because I still have old school DVDs, obviously. And in fact, the original idea for it was Tim Burton, much younger, pre-Disney, watching a store window changed from Halloween decorations to Christmas decorations. That gave him the whole thought.
Wow.
So
okay.
that was the original kind of nascent idea. Then it became this poem, which Burton did a bit of work on when he's at Disney and then he left because he just didn't fit in.
Mm.
But he could never let go of the idea and in the end had to do a deal with Disney that they would help him make it. But they had, at that stage, owned the property.
Right.
But when they had to actually then create the story beyond, you know, the concept, it was led by Elfman Songs. So Elfman actually wrote and recorded all the songs and the theme of the songs in consultation with Burton. He recorded the voice but got dumped at the last minute for Chris Sarandon, as you say, for doing the speaking voice. But it was song-led and they didn't have a script. So they got screenwriter Michael McDowell, who wrote Beetlejuice, amongst other things, officially to write the script, although apparently he didn't do much. He spent the money on salubrious activities, shall we say, and allegedly. And they didn't have a script. And in the end, they had a script written quite late in the piece by Caroline Thompson, who mm-hmm. was Elfman's, at that stage, partner.
Right.
They shared a house together. And she wrote a script, which then was played with quite a bit as they made the film in ways that she clearly didn't like. And if you're wondering where I'm getting all this information from, Netflix has just released a couple of new episodes of The Movies That Made Us. And they've done
right.
two Christmas films. They've done this film and they've done Elf that we talked about a couple
yes,
of Christmases ago.
Mm.
And talking to the different people, you know, the director, the screenwriter, Elfman and whoever else to tell the story of how it was made. And I think that actually comes through in the final film.
Mm.
So the final film, visually splendid. I'm a bit AC/DC about the songs. Like, what's this when Jack arrives in Christmas Town? I think works.
Yep.
A lot of them don't work for me.
Well, they're just not memorable to me. The songs really didn't stick in my brain.
It's a classic Disney kids film.
Yeah.
You'll walk out humming or singing one of the songs.
That's right.
Like a good Broadway show.
I don't do that with this film.
No. So it's really about, you know, songs for character
mm-hmm.
rather than songs that you carry with you.
Yeah, and this is not the first time I've tried to watch this. I thought, you know.
Have you never finished it before?
No, I've watched it, but the first time I watched it, I thought maybe I wasn't in the mood or whatnot. I'm in a really Christmassy mood at the moment. I'm trying to just enjoy. I couldn't wait to watch it, actually. And I just went, I'm still wanting more here, but I'm loving watching it. I'm loving the
Well,
the
I saw it on the big screen when it came out.
Yeah, right.
I took my 9-year-old nephew
to see
it.
That would have been amazing on the big screen.
But
yeah.
Again, it was visually very impressive.
Mm.
And I enjoyed it for that. And there are some scenes that really stand out, like the Mr. Oogie Boogie's song with the fluoro background when he's mm-hmm. taunting Santa. So there are parts which are visually splendid and deeply impressive, but you're not engaged. You're witnessing, but you're not engaged by the story. And I think that's its flaw.
Yeah.
I mean, this film is only 70 minutes long once you take out the end credits. And the end credits aren't particularly entertaining.
But it actually feels longer than that to me.
It does. But there are things that I really enjoy about it. You can quite clearly see other influences. So, you know, Christmas Town, there's very much Dr. Seuss there. And even the opening poem has the Dr. Seuss kind of meter to it.
It does have that. I started really looking at it technically. When I start getting drawn out of it because of the, you know, the story is not just taking me, then I'll look at what they did technically and how, and so I start marveling at that, which is not the way you sort of want to watch a movie, and you hope it's going to draw you in a little bit more than
that. We want to be immersed and then you can admire it.
That's right. Yeah.
Whereas you sort of admire this from a distance.
I agree.
I think that Jack and Zero are quite clearly the Grinch and his dog Max.
Yes.
So there's Zeus there. I felt a bit of Ronald Searle at some stage, the guy who did illustrations for St. Trinian's and How to Be Top.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see influences like Edward Gorey in it as well. As I say, visually, it is splendid. It really is splendid. It's story.
I know a lot of people who love this movie, though.
I know,
And really treasure it and are moved by it. So this is just an opinion because I know there's, you know, I mean, I think it's got an 8 out of 10 on IMDb rating, and that's a lot of ratings on there. So I know a lot of people do love it, but it's just an opinion of mine. I really admire it technically, but not... But not story-wise.
It's not a film that you'll go back to and watch again and again at Christmas, for example.
No.
Like you might with something like The Elf or It's a Wonderful Life.
No.
I do want to just drop two little facts on you.
Yeah, sure.
One of which might date me a bit. But the first one is that, of course, Henry Selick is also a director of Disney's James and the Giant Peach.
Of course he is.
Which I prefer as a film.
That's right, yes. Well, I prefer... That is a great film, actually. But I prefer Coraline as well over this.
Oh, yeah, so do I, yes. I really like Coraline.
It's really, really good. That's my favourite
And maybe it's because Henry didn't own it. You know, he was doing Tim's work and trying to put his own spin on it. But in the end, ultimately... You know, it's not his story as such.
I actually love Henry Selick's work. When Coraline came out and I watched that, I really marvelled at that as well.
Yeah.
It was one of the darkest kids' films I've seen in a long time.
And it's spookier than this.
It is much spookier.
Well, my second little fact. So there's some minor characters in it who are the witches in Halloween Town, who sort of flying around and doing things and make comments every now and then. The voice for those witches is Billy Hayes. Now, that probably means nothing to you.
No.
And what I'm going to say next might mean nothing to you because we are half a generation apart. But Billie Hayes' biggest claim to fame is she was Witchy Poo in H.R. Puff and Stuff.
Great.
Did you ever watch that?
No, I never watched H.R. Puff and Stuff.
So I like the synchronicity or the full circledness of Witchy Poo doing the voices of the witches in this.
That's great.
Yeah.
I'm glad you got that.
I can tell you are so excited. All right, so let's roll with your excitement and say, and what would you give it?
Look, I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same.
I was erring on a 6, quite honestly, because the story-wise, because I really want films to engage me, but I just thought, no, at the time, and what they did with this for over 3 years and how wonderful it is technically, it really deserves a 7.
Well, actually, I was coming the other way. I was thinking, should I give it an 8 because it is so amazing technically and visually? You know, it's a visual treat. But because the story's not there and because I don't feel warm about it.
No.
It's an admiration rather than an enjoyment.
Yes.
That brings it back to a 7 for me.
Mm, snap.
Yeah.
So the next film we're going to discuss is 1983's A Christmas Story. Greg, go for it.
There's a good chance that you haven't heard of this 1983 film before, but also a good chance that you have. That's because it seems to have become a nostalgic pop cultural reference point in the US. I've long heard mention of the 9-year-old central character, Ralphie, played by Peter Billingsley, who yearns for the ultimate Christmas present, an air rifle, and of a hilarious part where his friend's tongue gets stuck to a frozen flagpole due to a dare. Well, you had me at a hero called Ralphie, given that's my surname. So I suggested to Ricardo that this year we watch this small-town American classic. I'm sorry to say that I found it for the most part quite tedious, and I'm a bit mystified as to why it's so popular. It opens with a modern-day narrator recalling his 1950s childhood, presented by Jean Shepherd, the author of the stories on which the film is based. I found this self-amused voiceover quickly wearing, but assumed it was there to set things up and would soon go away. Except that it didn't. The first scene of note showed kids and their grown-ups marvelling at an animated toy display window. Anyone who has grown up in Melbourne, like Ricardo and me, well understands that our local equivalent, the Meyer window, is a cornerstone of a Melbourne Christmas, whether you're being taken into the big city to see it as a child, or later taking your own children in turn. So I was primed and ready for this Christmas story's possibilities. But even in this opening scene, I was annoyed by how obviously the children's noses were pressed up against the glass. It smacked of clumsy direction. And I noticed a few times throughout the film that child actors would look at the camera when they weren't supposed to. The film tells the story of young Ralphie's various stratagems to get the Red Ryder Carbine Action 200-shot range model air rifle for Christmas, and various family and schoolyard incidents along the way. At times, Ralphie enjoys over-the-top fantasies of his quest being thwarted and supported by reimagined versions of his family, teacher, and others. These fantasy sequences, and indeed most of the film's first half, were filled with overacting, including the performances of Darren McGavin and Melinda Dillon as Ralphie's parents. Now, I normally enjoy McGavin's performances, and I have very fond memories of his reporter Carl Kolchak in the 1970s TV series The Night Stalker. So this was doubly disappointing. The film quickly lost me, which was a pity because there were some genuinely funny and moving parts. It was amusing when Ralphie encounters a particularly mean department store Santa and elves. And similarly amusing and a little bit amazing when Ralphie's friend Flick, Scott Schwartz, gets his tongue stuck to the frozen flagpole. And the parents became more rounded characters as the film progressed. I thought the Christmas morning scenes really did work. They were the most real depiction I think I've seen of what Christmas morning is really like. And it was genuinely moving when the father, seemingly offhandedly, grants his son's heart's desire. The problem is that when the good bits do come along, they feel like too little too late. And then when Ralphie finally gets to try out his air rifle, it happens so quickly that it seems like an anticlimax, rather than the culmination of all that's gone before. I have problems with a film where the child hero savagely hoes into a bully for quite a long time without consequences or learning. And I don't want to apply my 21st century sensibilities too much to an early 80s film, but I don't know what to make of a family film which ends with the hero falling asleep on Christmas night, dreamily nestling into his gun, seemingly without irony. As I said earlier, I'm a bit mystified as to why this film is a Christmas classic. It feels dated rather than nostalgic, like an American TV episode from the 70s or 80s. Perhaps it's an American nostalgia for small-town American Christmases, as evidenced by the many, many, many Hallmark Christmas movies that currently fill our streaming services. Or perhaps like Dinner for One that we reviewed last Christmas, it's evolved as a family tradition from watching it in the lead-up to many Christmases. I don't have those contexts, so I can't judge the film on that basis. So I feel like Scrooge saying this, but I found this film largely charmless and I won't be watching it again. Ricardo, are you up for a bar humbug?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I didn't like this film much at all, really. You're right about so much of it. We agree on this one. The voiceover, I mean, voiceover in it has a place in screenplays, right? But it shouldn't be there to literally dominate
yeah.
the story, okay? There were so many times there were moments where the acting was fine and the situation was fine, but then this voiceover comes in, you're like, just shut up.
Yeah.
You know? And it wasn't great acting. The voiceover wasn't great either, and it wasn't moving. It didn't do anything for me.
Well, it's because he's the actual author.
Yeah, right.
But the whole thing felt a bit Amityville.
Oh, very much so. Oh, even the stage scenes. I mean, you're right, it was clumsily directed, and I... Look, the first half of the film, I really hated. I was like putting hands on a chalkboard.
My wife gave up and left.
Yeah, I was just going, like, I can't believe it was only an hour and a half movie. And I thought, oh my God, it's actually a short film. It's shorter than usual. But it felt like 2 hours, that first 45 minutes. And I'm sitting there just pulling my hair out going, oh, but then I fell asleep. So I had to actually watch the second half. But amazingly, as the film progresses, you're right. It actually does get better.
Yeah.
And the characters become nicer and better as well. And so I... You're right.
And more well-rounded.
Much better. Yeah,
The father goes from this kind of caricature who swears at the furnace.
What is about the lamp?
And likes doing the lamp, contests.
Who's got a fetish on legs and lamp. I don't know what's going on there.
Well, it wasn't... I don't think the fetish was about the leg. The fetish was, I won a prize for a quiz contest or something. That was his thing.
Yeah.
But this film story, they've taken anecdotes and incidents from about 2, 3, 4 different books and put them together into a screenplay. And the part that works is the part around Christmas morning.
Oh, it was great. Yeah, it was fun.
And eventually the mother-father-son relationship. The brother's pretty much a cutout all the way through, except for that scene where he, is chewing up his food like a pig. That actually gave you a bit more insight into the mother. But the brother is almost a non-character.
Overlong dream sequences. Oh, my God. They just went on and on. And we're really... badly done as well. I mean, really, a little bit of a vignette,
and again, the clumsy direction. Yeah. So when the younger brother is wrapped up in too many clothes, so he can't put his arms down, and he falls over in the snow, and the main character Ralphie and his friends have to help him up, but then the child actor playing the brother is actually getting himself up in that moment, and so the director's not paying attention.
No, but you're right. The performances were way over the top as well. I mean, the mother and the father actually became more well-rounded and better. They were better performances. When he gets the gun, finally gets the gun. The mother and the father are wonderful in that scene, and it's a really lovely scene.
Yeah,
giving and the child getting what he really desired.
I think they've got more to work with too as actors. At that point.
All the other stuff and all the dream sequences are really overacted, really bad. I was excruciating, Greg. It was excruciating.
Yes.
It wasn't like it was just bad. It was excruciating. I did not want to finish this movie, but I had to.
You loved it so much you wanted it to never end. Is that what you're saying?
Luckily the second half did was better, but I agree that when he's punching that kid in the face... It went on for a very long time.
And the kid's got blood on his face.
I'm sitting there going, okay. It's from getting back at a bully to you've got issues, Ralphie.
Yeah.
Ralphie's got
issues.
Because it went from, just getting back at a bully. Ugh. But yeah, sleeping with a gun. I think it's a very American culture thing. It must be. Because guns are so entrenched in the culture.
Well, that was very much in my mind. And I don't want to oversimplify it.
No, that's right. No.
I mean, there's a nostalgia there for Little Orphan Annie. And it was interesting when Ralphie finally gets his Dakota ring that he's been saving up for by drinking lots and lots of Ovaltine. And I have to say, I was really impressed because I never knew what a Dakota ring actually was. I saw how it works and I got that out of the film. And he gets disappointed when he finds out that the secret message is just another ad for Ovaltine.
Mm.
And apparently there's a sequence that was cut with Flash Gordon and Ming the Merciless. They're two actors in the credits.
Fantastic, it was cut.
Well, quite probably, but, might have edged it over into so bad it's good kind of territory.
Yeah, but if that scene got cut...
And the rest got...
Yeah, the rest
got in. Might have been copyright reasons, who knows?
Possibly, I don't know.
I have to say, I also felt a little bit uncomfortable with the scene with the singing Chinese waiters on Christmas morning who couldn't sing... so they sang L's, was it?
Yeah.
So it was I can't even think what they were singing, deck the halls with boughs of horry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that kind of thing. It was like...
I felt a bit Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah, well, and again, look, the film is made in 83.
Yeah.
And that might have been hysterically funny in 83, maybe.
A lot of great films were made in the 80s and early 80s and the end of 70s, so I'm not going to blame it on the... on the time.
No, I mean, but the sensibilities. I think we're more sensitive to those kind of things, depictions.
That's true too.
Particularly maybe in the last 10 years.
Yeah. But look, my son found it a bit boring in the first half on a Christmas movie with kids, about kids. But then he actually got into it more in the second half, as I did. I mean, I thought this is actually a little bit better.
But, there are film critics that I respect, so Leonard Maltin, Robert Ebert, who all rated this film highly when it came out, so before it was nostalgia. So Ebert gave the film 4 stars out of 4.
What?
And added,
what?
Yes, and added the film to his great movies list.
You know what? I looked at the IMDb. I think it gets it like 7 out of 10 on IMDb. I'm sitting there going, how? And then there's like 10 out of 10. This is a great film. Oh, it warms my heart. It's nostalgic. It's all that. I'm like, what did you see in this movie?
Well, but you can imagine that people associate it with their own family sitting down to watch it.
And that's why
it's one of the great movies of my life.
Yeah.
But when you stand back from that, which I think you and I can do because we're not of that time and culture, then we can see it through different eyes. But Leonard Maltin, he also gave it 4 stars out of 4 and called the film delightful and truly funny for kids and grown-ups alike with wonderful period flavour. And it is very rare for me to diverge from Leonard Maltin.
Leonard Maltin, jeepers.
But on this case, we're worlds apart. Again, maybe it's contextual.
That surprises me to no end because The Godfather gets 4 stars.
Oh, well.
Not.
I'm sorry, The Godfather is no Christmas story.
Francis Ford Coppola gets 4 stars, not this clumsily directed piece of absolute drivel.
Oh, I think drivel's harsh.
No, it's not harsh. It was drivel. Yeah, it was. It wasn't great.
So is this film getting a positive score from you?
No, it's getting a 2 out of 10.
Well, it's positive. It's not below zero.
Well, it's not below zero because I thought it picked up a little bit in the second half. And I thought, well, if you got finance on this movie, that's fantastic. Well done for you. You deserve 1 credit for that. So I was going to give it 1 out of 10, but I thought, geez, you got it made, so 2.
Well, I was going to, I was trying to work out how it stacked up against Cabaret. What did I give Cabaret?
Four.
Okay, well. Yeah, sure. So I'm giving this a 3. It's not quite as good as Cabaret. This is my Christmas joke. No, it's a 3.
Jokes like I said, on you.
And it gets a 3 for 2 reasons. It gets a 3 for showing me what a Dakota ring is. A bit like when I gave half a mark to Showgirls for that dress. And I also give it a few marks because the Christmas morning scene for me really does work. I did like that. And if the whole film was like that, I think I would treat this like a rewatchable classic.
The ending was much better.
So, yeah. Did you say 3? No, 2. You said 2. Well, I like it a bit more, but might be just because of the Dakota ring. Well, we're not going too well on the old Christmassy spirit so far. So let's see how we go on our last movie, which is Last Christmas from last year, 2019.
I've been wanting to see this film because I always like Paul Feig films. Bridesmaids was obviously a highlight, but I also like The Heat and also his Ghostbusters remake, which I think is unfairly criticised. Here, however, he jumped across the pond to the UK to make this lovely UK comedy romance. The film begins in Yugoslavia, where a young Katerina sings beautifully in a choir with her dad, young sister and mum Petra, Emma Thompson, watching on. Petra can't contain herself from being overly emotional at Katerina's beautiful voice. Cut to the present day, and Katerina, now known as Kate and played by Emilia Clarke, is down on her luck in London, working as an elf in a Christmas store whose owner is a woman who goes by the name Santa, Michelle Yeoh. She thinks Kate has a lot of potential, but is lazy. But things aren't going great for Kate. She's continually losing the trust of her close people around her. She arrives late at an audition, only to screw it up. She forgets to lock up the shop, which gets robbed and destroyed overnight. And she feels pretty much homeless because she doesn't want to stay with her oversensitive mum, Petra. Even her father finds it hard to be around her. Petra always worries for Kate after she had a major operation. One day, she meets Tom, Henry Golding, outside her shop, who she likes and finds charming, but also a little bit odd. He has a phone, but keeps it in his cupboard at home because he doesn't want it ruling his life. He also says he works voluntarily at a homeless shelter. And even though a bird poops on her face, spoiling the moment, he returns to see her. Firstly, rejecting him, she then gives in and he takes her for a walk around the city, asking her to look up and notice things she hasn't seen in places she's been many times. He even takes her to a lovely little city garden spot where he goes to sit and think. She starts feeling better about herself when she is around him and opens up to him, telling him about an illness she had in which she required a heart transplant and it made her feel bad about herself in that she was half dead due to needing help. Kate then asks Tom to kiss her goodnight, which he does. However, when she tries to see him again, Tom tells her that she just can't keep depending on him. Now, she just feels like he's just another guy leading her on and leaves. Finally going home to stay with Mum, Petra, she upsets her sister, outing her as gay to her parents, and then she goes looking for Tom, who is nowhere to be seen. Upon checking the homeless shelter, she strikes a nice relationship with the homeless and starts singing outside to make some money for the homeless, giving her a purpose. When she finally finds Tom and discovers his story, it's so beautiful and heartbreaking at the same time. I definitely needed the tissues with this one. Look, I just love this. Emilia Clarke is just wonderful and very different to Daenerys Targaryen in Game of Thrones. I really loved her in this. But so is Henry Golding. In fact, everyone is great. From Emma Thompson, really, is she ever not great, to Michelle Yeoh, whose bizarre romance with Danish man Peter Mygind is quite funny. Yes, the screenplay can be formulaic and at times a bit overly sentimental, but this has so much heart to it. I really felt for Kate, and her love story to Tom is one I'll absolutely remember. I even watched it a second time and will no doubt become a film I watch repeatedly. Look, any fan of George Michael will also love this film. Kate just loves George Michael, so this film uses so many songs of his to match her feelings throughout the film, and obviously Last Christmas is the title.
Now, we could sing that now and really spoil it for those people who try not to hear the song before Christmas.
But look, I wasn't disappointed at all. Greg, what did you think?
I think it's a lovely film. You know, it's a charming film. I talked about A Christmas Story being charmless. This is charming. Mm. It feels almost a bit Richard Curtis territory.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the original idea came from Emma Thompson and her husband, Greg Wise, where I think they were being a bit clever with George Michael's famous song Last Christmas. Mm-hmm. Again, we are being very careful not to give away a plot point in this film because we don't want to spoil it for people. But you can see where the original idea came from. And then Emma Thompson was the co-screenwriter of the film. I think that she probably is my favourite actor, certainly favourite living actor. Mm. She is so good. And I was thinking about in the 12 months leading up to this film, she played quite different parts.
Oh, absolutely.
So she played the not very nice Prime Minister in the TV series Years and Years. She played a late night TV host working in America on Late Night.
I really enjoyed that too.
Yep, so did I. She's done some big things like, you know, Johnny English Number 3 and Men in Black International, the big blockbuster kind of things, where she's pretty much doing Emma Thompson. But in this, I have to say, I saw this when it came out at the movies last year.
Yeah.
And both then and when I watched it again this week, at the start, I think, I'm not sure about her character. Like, she's playing this Yugoslavian woman and she's doing the accent and the mannerisms. And at first I thought, this could be a bit caricature.
Yeah, I thought she did really well
with it. But then it becomes a real woman. She does it so, so well.
She does.
She's a great actor. She's obviously a talented screenwriter, you know, Sense and Sensibility, for example.
She's a massive talent and I just love her. I just think she's great in everything. Everything she does is so watchable. She lifts films. Like, I think Late Night was a good movie, but because of her, she lifted that movie so much.
Yeah.
So her presence elevates a movie. I mean, she's a secondary character in this. So yep. I think Emilia Clarke and Henry Golding, I think that she was great, and I really
I think they're both very good for their parts. And yeah. I hadn't seen either of them. I'm not a
Game of Thrones.
I think I was going to say Dungeons and Dragons.
Dungeons and Dragons.
I'm not a Game of Thrones. What is this Game of Thrones of which you speak? I watched half an episode and just didn't bother.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm now disillusioned. Fans of A Christmas Story. And I'm now going for the Game of Thrones mob. What's next? Sit back and find out. So I didn't know her. I have yet to see Crazy Rich Asians. I just haven't got around to it. I do want to watch it.
Oh, me too. I haven't watched that either.
So I didn't know Henry Golding. They both are so well cast in these parts. Yeah, they're spot on.
They are.
Michelle Yeoh was a revelation in her
part. Fantastic. I love that whole story. You know, it was really lovely.
And her relationship with Kate.
It was beautiful.
Because Kate does, when she doesn't lock the shop up and it gets broken into.
Yeah.
And Michelle Yeoh's character, Santa, says that, you know, I should fire you. but I'm going to give you another chance. A lot of people wouldn't do that.
No, they wouldn't.
And I love the little bit where she explains that Santa's not her real name. She changed her name for the retail she works in.
Yeah, so I love
at the,
it.
At the bakery, she was Muffin.
Yes.
And at the health food shop, she was Miso.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, she had a great part to work with there as well.
She did.
And then that weird romance out of nowhere with the sauerkraut salesman.
You know what? I just love that. That was just so offbeat and just this guy is he's such a weird guy, but it's so it just worked.
It does.
I also love the homeless shelter stuff. I thought that was really heartwarming.
Well, there's a moral to the story in this film, and that is that Kate is completely off the rails, as you say.
She is.
She's self-destructive. Mm. She's doing the wrong thing by her sister and some of her friends and their relationships.
Yeah.
So, you know, the electrocuted fish and the broken craft project.
Poor thing.
She's completely off the rails. And it is kind of Tom that brings her back. But really what it is that she starts to look outside herself.
Yes.
And the things that frighten her since she was ill. And you understand that. You know, it's a real journey.
Absolutely.
You get it.
It is.
But she becomes something other because she helps other people. You know, she does the busking outside the homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. She goes in and feeds them. She gets involved in the Christmas concert.
Well, to me, that's all done so well, you know, from her off the rails to sort of finding, you know...
it feels genuine.
...that purpose to finding, you know, finding things which are going to make her look up and see more than what she has been, you know, outwardly. So I think...
Well, there's a great sense of place in this film.
Yeah.
And you're actively encouraged to do that because of his instruction to Kate of look up, which is something I actually try and do around Melbourne because we don't look up enough. I think that's absolutely spot on.
But I find you do that when you go overseas and when you go to a new place overseas, you look up a lot. You spend a lot of time looking up and you take in so much.
And like Melbourne has some very interesting architecture and statuary.
A lot of people wouldn't know.
That's exactly right. But it's also that there's a very lovely sense of place and location in this film. So the shop is in Covent Garden.
I used
to live in London for a little while. Mm. So I know Covent Garden. I knew it straight away.
Yeah.
There are places that didn't mean anything to me, meant bits of things like Brixton and other places they mention. But even when she first goes home to her parents' place, who live in this duplex townhouse thing, and the neighbours next door, the house is swimming in lights and their side is just bare. There's nothing.
That's right.
It's a little bunker kind of thing. Before you even go through the front door, you know something about this house and the family's culture.
Mm.
And a lovely thing about the film is how you see the family shift as a few pigeons come home to roost.
Yes, absolutely. And that's beautiful, you know, because it makes you feel really great at the end and what goes on there. Like I said, we can't say too much, but...
Well, we're being careful, but what's interesting watching it the second time is that there is a lot of clues being dropped around about something that's going on that you are completely oblivious to, but you then get that next level of meaning when you rewatch and think, okay,
that all
makes sense, but it's been really carefully constructed.
Yeah, and really well directed. You know, I think Paul Feig is a very good director and I really like his work. I put him a bit in the same vein as Judd Apatow. I really like Judd Apatow's films as well, but I really like Paul Feig's sensibilities.
Well, you mentioned Bridesmaids. What else did you mention?
The Heat. I like The Heat.
I haven't seen The Heat.
Yeah, with Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy.
No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah,
and you mentioned a third film.
Well, I like the Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters film, yes.
That is very maligned, and I know that a lot of people didn't like, but I think that's harshly criticised.
I think that Ghostbusters film, the ending just went so over the top, it lost its way. But until that, it was visually impressive, but the story just got lost. But up until that, I thought it was a very good reworking.
Yeah, me too. And it got a lot of backlash for being women and whatnot. I think that really got it was unfairly done, you know, unfairly criticised, that film.
Well, for me, it's like the new series of Doctor Who, and I know you're not a Doctor Who watcher, whereas I love Doctor Who. Mm. But at the moment, we've got the first female Doctor, and there's been a lot of pushback on that, and some of that is gender issues. But a lot of it is because the stories aren't as good. They're not as strong, and it's a new showrunner. And the fact that I think he's not quite got it, but it's around the first female Doctor, it's kind of like the genre is easier to attack. You're taking a boy's thing, you're making it a girl's thing, and look how bad it is, when it's not
Yes.
That which is at the heart of it. It's actually about what's happening to the story.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So you and I always say it's always about story.
It's always about story.
And the story is just spot on.
Yeah,
it's so well done.
It is. It's a really good screenplay and beautiful story.
And there's some nice side characters. I love the two police women.
Oh, my God. Didn't even mention the police women.
Ingrid Oliver, who I know is a British comedian, and Laura Evelyn, who I don't know, but they worked really well together.
They really did. That's the thing. This is what makes it so good. I mean, I even forgot about the police characters, but they are great. They're really good.
Well, because the film has layers. They've thought it through.
Yes, they
have. So I know from talking to you and some of your professional practice that, you know, a story, a script, has to go through many iterations.
It does,
You're picking up on different things.
Yeah.
And we've talked in the past about films where we say it didn't go around enough times.
Yeah.
This one obviously has.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I agree. And that's what attracts great cast as well. I mean, and I think Emilia Clarke, I mean, I think, you know, it was great to see her in such a different role, but I think that's more her,
Other than Dungeons and Dragons,
which I think she was great in as well. She's wonderful. So what great talent there.
And you talked about needing the tissues first time around, second time too?
Yep.
I did. And you know,
I think I'm going to need the tissues every time.
Yeah,
the final
concert.
This got me. It got me. No, not even the final. No, there's a few moments in there. Not the final concert didn't, but there's a few moments in there which did.
Oh, no, I agree. But for me, the final concert was a culmination.
Right.
And the fact that almost everyone was there.
Yeah.
And were celebrating and dancing. And it wasn't a big over-the-top concert. It felt like a community kind of concert.
Yeah, it did. They did that really well.
And the way when her outfit and then they open up the curtains, it just works.
It does work. Yeah, it does.
So, on balance, where are you going to put this?
I'm giving it an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I was leaning towards that, but actually I'm going to bump it up to 9 because it just...
Yeah, okay.
It's not a masterpiece.
No.
But it's a really good, solid film.
It is a solid film.
It's well constructed, it's well acted, it's well directed. It walks all over A Christmas Story.
Oh.
And while I admire, as we said, admire the technical craftsmanship of A Nightmare Before Christmas... The story isn't there, and the story is so, so here.
This made me smile. It made me laugh. It made me cry. It took me through a journey.
Yeah.
And that's what you want from a movie, to make you feel something. And, it really did. And it will do again, you know. It just touched me. It really touched me. And
it's not a long film. It's, you know, it's an hour 40 or so.
Yeah.
So it's a good length, but it's not, you know, it doesn't outstay its welcome either.
Mm. Yeah, loved it. So that concludes the 2020 Christmas special of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast.
Well, not so fast, Ricardo.
Okay.
Because you know that I like for our Christmas episodes to do something Christmassy.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a bit harder this year because we've been in lockdown, so not a lot of chances until quite recently to go shopping.
Yes.
And I did have something I bought last year, which was about a 5 or 6 foot high cracker. And I was tempted to bring it around and, explode it, but I just didn't know what your insurance was like. But I do have this.
That was loud last year. That was so loud.
That was more than a year ago.
Yeah, it was.
And that was only one of the normal size ones. So I have in my little bag here, sound effect of zipper, I have brought with me a singing reindeer and penguin.
Oh, wow.
Now,
okay.
This is particularly unusual because reindeers are meant to be North Pole and penguins are South Pole.
Okay.
But I've actually forgotten what it sings. I know it's something Christmassy, but I thought you can squeeze the foot and let's see what we get.
I'm about to squeeze the foot, which says press here.
Of the reindeer, not me.
Of the reindeer. And you know what? I'll go to our Instagram page. I'll get a picture with Greg with this toy so you can at least see what it looks like. Hang on. It says press here and it's not working.
Maybe I should turn it on.
Hang on. Is it on? Well, turn the thing on.
Try now. Sorry.
Turn the thing on.
That's the penguin. La 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 la.
Is this the horror special?
Can I just send out a special a shout out?
Yeah, sure.
to my Auntie Mari,
oh,
who loves penguins. This is actually part of her Christmas present.
Oh, is it?
But hopefully she won't listen.
Sorry.
Hopefully she won't listen to the podcast until after she opens it.
Sorry, it was a lovely.
I know, it's meant to be kitsch.
Yeah.
This is what I had for this year.
Well, that's lovely.
Fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la.
Well, look, we just wish you all around the world and wherever you're listening.
It's been a tough year.
It's been a tough year. And so try and have as good a Christmas as you can, whether you're in lockdown or not. Try and feel that Christmas spirit any way you can.
And if you're looking for some kind of inspiration to put that Christmassy spirit into your soul, you could do no better than...
Oh, jeepers. Have a great, great, great Christmas and a wonderful new year, everybody. Here's to a better 2021.
Fa la 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 la.